Hey folks, Scott Weingar here, and this is the MCRIP podcast. You might be wondering why I haven't discussed sepsis 3.0 on the podcast. And of course, we had a wonderful discussion of it on the blog by Josh Farkas. It may have been the most popular blog post ever on MCRIT on the new definitions. And how come I haven't discussed it on the podcast? Well, because I wanted to talk to the lead author of the new definition paper recently published in the JAMA, Mervyn Singer. Now, before we get there, I am not going to go into detail on the actual definitions. Why? Well, first of all, read the paper. And if all you did is read the abstract and then got things out of social media, you've already missed the boat. And Mervyn's had no end of frustration along with his co-authors because most of the complaints that he's been approached with were actually addressed in the paper. So if you haven't read the paper, read it. It's linked, the full text, in the show notes for this episode. Then, if you want some further places to go for definitions and understanding of what the sepsis 3.0 is actually doing, first go to the St. Emlyn's blog post linked in the show notes. And then, if you want to listen instead, listen to the Foamcast by Lauren Westifer and Jeremy Faust. They did a fantastic job. And then, read Josh Farkas's blog post on MCRIT, you know, PoemCRIT post. That's linked there as well. And then come and listen to this podcast with Mervyn Singer, the lead author. Here's how he described himself when I asked him for a Twitter-style bio for our recent SMAC conference. Intensivist, researcher, iconoclast, sex god. Well, you can't beat that. Mervyn's a professor of intensive care at University College in London. His primary research interests are sepsis and multi-organ failure, in addition to infection, shock, and hemodynamic monitoring. He is a superstar and a person, at least from my perspective, without ulterior motives, except to find the truth, if there is a truth, on these matters and help our patients. So I couldn't find anyone I would have rather talked to about these new sepsis definitions than Mervyn Singer. Let's get right to it. So excited to be able to talk to you, Mervyn. You are the person who's going to solve all the confusion on these matters.
Well, I'm not sure about that. Actually, it's funny. I've been getting people saying to me, why don't you join Twitter? And I said, well, I'm not a tweeter.
Well, actually, people just want your mustache on Twitter.
Well, which is understandable. You know, my body would just overexcite them.
Oh, fantastic. Let's jump right into it. So you have emailed me and told me that you think there's a whole bunch of misunderstandings about sepsis 3.0 being portrayed in the social media world. And I want to know, what do you think these misunderstandings are and why are people getting it wrong?
In a nutshell, what we're trying to do is just bring the definitions up to date. You know, so the last ones were done in 2001, and our thinking about sepsis has moved on. So we now don't think of it purely as an inflammatory response to an infection. You know, if you have a bad cold, that can give you two of the four SIRS criteria at least. And then by the old definition, you're septic, and clearly you've got a bad cold. So we understand better that it's not just about inflammation. There's an anti-inflammatory response and lots of other things. The second issue, which we wanted when we were coming up with the definitions, there was nothing in the previous iterations to tell people what did they mean by organ dysfunction? What did they mean by septic shock? And so as a result, it meant all things to all people, just depended what database you could tap into. And so as a result, you got these huge differences in incidence, in mortality. And so from an epidemiology point of view, from a coding point of view, it created chaos. And so we thought, well, at least let's come up with some didactic clinical descriptors, which would help people talk the same language. So we didn't have, for example, we showed in the septic shock analysis that you could get fourfold differences in mortality between, for example, Australia and Germany and Italy. So does that mean Australia's four times better?
Post-podcast Weingar chiming in here just to say, the Australians clearly think it's because they're four times better.
Or the Italians and the Germans are four times worse. No, it really comes down to how you describe and identify, in inverted commas, septic shock. The next thing we wanted to do was, you know, we felt we didn't want to just keep the sepsis definition sort of for the rarefied environment of academic medicine. So we wanted to offer the bedside clinician something that isn't intended to be a management tool, but is intended to be a risk stratifier. And, you know, we can have a lively debate on, does every patient who walks in through the door with a temperature need an antibiotic? I'm of the school that says definitely not. But, you know, there are believers who feel, oh, you know, if you don't give them the early antibiotic, you know, they'll die, which I think the literature would support my side of the argument. But we wanted to offer something that would risk stratify. And so, again, because we were doing this big data analysis, so rather than a load of grey-haired, in inverted commas, experts coming up with what they thought sepsis should and shouldn't be, we interrogated big data to say, well, hey, this is what the data shows. So we wanted the new sepsis to reflect organ dysfunction, and we used the SOFA score, or looking at the change in SOFA score, and the big data showed that just having a SOFA score of 2 at the time it presumed infection was diagnosed or cultured and antibiotics started, that in that patient population there was a 10% mortality risk, which is pretty significant. We thought, can we simplify it even further? SIRS requires doing blood tests to look at the white count, etc. And so Chris Seymour, when he did his analysis, found that he put in 21 variables into the pot and found that respiratory rate, mental status, and blood pressure came out top of the list. And if you had none of those three criteria in the window, either a 6-hour or a 72-hour window around which infection was suspected, cultures were taken, antibiotics started, you had a really low, below 1% chance of dying. If you had one of these three criteria, it was about 2 to 3%. If you had two of the criteria, 8%. If you had three of the criteria, over 20%. So where people, I think, are getting it wrong, they're saying, oh, we're advocating that people shouldn't be treated until they hit 2Q SOFA criteria. Absolutely not. We're absolutely not saying that. If you're worried about the patient, you start treating them. If they're oliguric, you don't wait. If they're hypoxemic, you don't wait. You start treating them. And so the label, sepsis, is a label of a syndrome, but you're not going to delay treating them until they've met the magic number. You know, you treat the patient in front of you just like you treat patient who comes in with a hemorrhagic, you know, major GI bleed. You know, you treat them as they appear in front of you. And if they're sick, you're more aggressive with your treatment than if they're not unwell. Yeah, no, so it was very much a case of we're not saying, and we made the point in the paper, this is not a management trigger. This is purely a means of stratifying, risk stratifying a patient. So if you're monitoring the patient and they go, for example, from QSOFA 0 to 1 to 2, that's telling you something about that patient. And so if you're not already intervening, perhaps you ought to be intervening, or intervening more aggressively, perhaps transferring them to a critical care environment, whatever. Again, depends on the facilities you have in your hospital and the patient in front of you and how they're appearing, and if they're decompensating or not. But it just flags up that this patient might be sicker than we actually thought, or perhaps they're getting worse. So it's a track and trigger type of system.
I think you've put your finger on it, which is people, especially in the emergency medicine world, are looking always for a screening mechanism. And when they look at QSOFA, they say, wow, this is not a screen. This probably has specificity. It makes sense to us that patients with two or three of these certainly are sick, but it's certainly not an early warning. And from what you're saying, Mervyn, you never intended it to be that, you and your conspirators. Is that correct?
Absolutely. It's a risk stratifier.
Okay.
Interestingly, so, sorry, go on.
No. If you're going to start a phrase with interestingly, I want to hear it. Go ahead.
Oh, you're beautiful. You can keep that in the cup. And one of the things, again, in the paper, we made the point saying you don't have to abandon something that you're happy with to incorporate QSOFA, but start looking at it and see, well, is it better than SIRS? Is it better than lactate? And so we're just opening the door, the invitation to say, prospectively validate it in your healthcare setting, but we're not saying throw the baby out with the bathwater, abandon everything you've been doing for years, and immediately take up QSOFA. And again, that message, hopefully, my strident tones emphasizing our strong recommendation to prospectively validate would hopefully reassure, you know, we're not trying to take over the world with QSOFA. We're saying, here, the big data done on hundreds of thousands of patients suggests that this is as good. You don't need to measure lactate if you don't want to, in terms of 2-QSOFA, adding lactate to that adds nothing.
At this point, Dr. Singer and I had a few-minute conversation on the difference between what I think many emergency departments are looking for, which is a screen that could be done early on, preferably in triage. And, you know, I'll put the one I have been using with my work with the Greater New York Hospital Sepsis Collaborative. And we think it's pretty good. We think it's something that could be done by nursing at triage to kind of find the patients who you should even take a look at for sepsis. And then the other thing you need is what I think QSOFA is going to, you know, maybe in its current form, maybe in a slightly altered form, provide a very good use for, which is once you've found a patient you think is infected, you think maybe septic, to actually screen how severe that infection is. And I think the conflation of those two separate goals is part of the clamoring we hear on the internet. And then at the tail part of that conversation that I've edited out, Mervyn started talking about why ultra early determination of sepsis or no sepsis is maybe not really the win, and that this idea that we have to ultra rapidly identify these patients, at least from the ultra early antibiotic perspective, may not be the case. And let's go right back into that.
There's this paranoia, and I, again, different debate, different podcast, but I think the evidence base that early antibiotics saves lives, to my mind, is rather weak. There's a huge amount of contradictory data that would undermine that argument, you know. And so I'm not saying deny the patient antibiotics, don't get me wrong, but this belief that because we haven't got a clue when time zero is not when the patient presents to hospital. There's some time, often an indeterminate time before they presented to hospital, that the infection's developing and maybe the organ dysfunction's developing. And so time zero from when they pitch up in the emergency department is a spurious time zero. And you guys in the emergency department have shown it yourself with time to first dose of antibiotic for chest infection, you know, and it's not been shown to be a reliable marker of quality because the outcomes don't match up.
Fair enough. The second part of that question, Murph, was when we, we as part of the American Emergency Medicine Societies wrote to Society of Critical Care Medicine about the lactate question, most of the stuff we got back was lactate greater than 2 didn't really add much to the mix. My question is, the screening we were doing was patients with a lactate greater than 4, greater than or equal to 4. And that seems to be a different group. And we didn't get any real response to the patient that doesn't have 2-QSOFA but does have a lactate of 5 and what to do about that patient.
Well, again, the answer I would give there, well, can I answer initially with some anecdote and then answer with some data?
For sure.
The interesting thing, and I know, you know, because obviously you had the process trial, the early goal-directed trial in the US, there was a rise in Australasia, New Zealand, and the PROMISE trial in the UK, and I was one of the PIs in the PROMISE trial. And interestingly, the entry criteria was a lactate greater than 4 or a low blood pressure that didn't respond to fluid. But the lactate could be, you could enroll a patient before fluid resuscitation. Yep, it's...
Yep.
That was, and all three trials operated to the same criteria. Now, a good number of patients, not huge numbers, but there were enough, and certainly in the UK, I don't know about the US, but certainly in the UK, and the Australians have told me the same, that after the initial couple of litres of fluid that they got before they were enrolled in the trial, they got no fluid afterwards, apart from cups of tea. So they had responded really, really quickly to whatever gave them the lactate of four.
All right. At this point, we had some further, very productive back and forth about whether lactate still has a role. And Mervyn actually quoted some data for recent projects from the NICE in the UK, showing that many of the lactate studies lack precision or didn't even measure precision. And there's issues with the fact that the clinicians involved in these trials showing lactate's association with badness knew about the lactate, and that somewhat affects the validity of these studies. I maintain that while a lactate between 2 and 4 may not add much value, if I see a lactate of 6, I'm a little bit worried about that patient and might continue to send lactates early on. We still need them to define septic shock, as you'll soon see. So sending them still is imperative. For a patient you deem to be septic, I'll probably still send them. And if I see a lactate come back greater than 4, even in the absence of 2Q-SOFA, I'm still going to be worried and potentially do things like admit the patient to the hospital, like give early antibiotics, like give a reasonable amount of fluid to those patients, and consider them, in my mind, probably, if I think they're infected with a lactate greater than 4, to be septic, but not necessarily septic shock by these new definitions. And I think there's certainly enough latitude in the sepsis 3.0 paper, the what they intended, which is not this is a be-all, end-all, to accept my viewpoint on this. And then so we'll let Mervyn close off the lactate section, and then we'll go on.
I like lactate. You know, I use lactate. It's a nice way of knowing if the patient's improving, the lactate generally does come back to normal. And so I'm going to still carry on using lactate as part of my management process. But all we're saying in terms of for the diagnosis of sepsis, you know, in terms of the SOFA, because lactate's not in there, you don't need it. For the risk stratification, certainly if you had 2 or more Q-SOFA, you didn't need lactate. Lactate added a bit to 1 Q-SOFA criteria, but not 2 or more. So we're saying just purely in terms of definitions, diagnosis, lactate isn't necessary. However, you know, and again, we stressed in the paper, if you want to use it as a clinical tool, please do. We're absolutely not dissuading, discouraging, arguing against lactate. So again, and that was a point we made to the emergency med colleges. You know, if people want to use lactate, please do. We're not saying don't use it. Please, if you're comfortable with it, like it, carry on using it.
Well, yeah, now I have to ask this question, Merv, not because I necessarily want the answer, but I've been spurred to ask it, and we'll get it out of the way. Why were no emergency medicine folks at the table when these were being discussed?
Well, I think life in general, in retrospect, you know, you feel, oh yeah, we should have done. What we did when we did it, we had a limited amount of funding, number one. What Cliff Deutschman and I, we were charged to do it, and what we wanted to do was have people with a broad mix of interests. So we had the epidemiologists, the clinical trialists, the people who are interested in organs, immune system, etc. So we had this big mix. You know, in retrospect, you know, hands up, you know, and we've actually said this to the emergency med societies, that yes, we didn't do it by specialty. So we didn't think, right, we've got a surgeon, we've got an ID doc, we've got a emergency med doc. So in retrospect, yeah, and you know, we've put our hands in the air, owned up, and say, "Yep, we screwed up." But what we did do when it became apparent to me anyway that, oh look, we haven't got an emergency med doc. So I actually spoke to some emergency physicians and said, "Look, we will definitely," which we did do, "involve you guys when it comes to the peer review process." So we wrote to emergency med docs in obviously the US and the two different societies, the European Society, the Japanese Society, as part of the Royal Colleges in the UK, the Emergency Medicine Royal College was involved there. And so we did go out to emergency med societies, as well as respiratory, as well as in ID, microbiology, to get their opinions.
Well, let me ask you two quick questions on the sepsis definitions, because then I want to get to the septic shock, which I find far more interesting and important, and I love them, so it will end on a happy note. But the two questions on the septic screening are, one, I have to ask about the SOFA portion for the patients actually in ICU. Many of the academic centers in the U.S. are not currently calculating SOFA. And are you folks saying that they should be and they should start now?
Again, what we, had lots and lots of discussion about, because going back to the comments I made right at the outset, you know, organ dysfunction could mean anything to anybody. So we needed to give something that people could hang their hats on. This is what we mean by organ dysfunction. SOFA's not perfect, absolutely not claiming it is, and we've said that in the paper, but it's been around a long time. And the beauty about SOFA is it uses things, measures that are just routinely measured in any unwell patient. So you're looking at renal function, bilirubin, platelets, gases. So these are things that you would routinely measure in any patient you're worried about. So the ability, the capability of measuring SOFA should be easy in any patient with organ dysfunction, because you'll be measuring them anyway. So we're not asking for some special fancy test that many hospitals can't do. Can it be easily measured? Yes. We have an EHR in our ICU, the ISIP system, that's a sort of Philips system, and it measures it. We get SOFA given to us daily. Again, it doesn't change our management. We're not going to treat the patient any differently that their SOFA's 2 or 5. But again, you're looking at the patient, looking at trends, if the SOFA's going up or down. But again, the SOFA is more, I would argue, for epidemiology, for coding, so that everyone talks the same language.
Merv, last question on the sepsis stuff, the sepsis before we get the septic shock. I thought sure. I had understood reading the paper how this stuff was supposed to work. And then I came to a flow chart within the paper. Mm. And the flow chart seems to indicate that if my Q-SOFA is greater than or equal to 2, before I could diagnose sepsis, I have to now do the full SOFA screening in order to get to sepsis. That seems to be a pathway that if their SOFA doesn't make it, then now they're not septic, even though their Q-SOFA is greater than or equal to 2. Am I misunderstanding? I thought I knew how to read flow charts.
You're absolutely spot on. Yeah, no, again, when we had the QSOFA data from Chris Seymour, we had a lot of discussion about how much weight should we put on these retrospective data, you know, and we recognized that they were retrospectively collected over a time window. And so it would be a big leap of faith to say QSOFA equals sepsis. It may well turn out to be if we prospectively look at QSOFA in different situations, but we thought it was brave, bold, you know, perhaps too bold to actually make that leap of faith without the prospective data. So we're saying at the moment, QSOFA is a prompt to make you think this patient is at high risk of having sepsis. Ergo, if they have 2 or more QSOFA, they're sick, they've got an over 8% chance of dying with 2, QSOFA over 20% with 3 QSOFA criteria. So these patients warrant having the blood tests and looking at their organ function, which will make you then be able to diagnose on the SOFA change of 2 or more that they have sepsis. Clearly, the flowchart says if the QSOFA is not 2 or more and you're still worried about the patient, you know, they might have a good blood pressure, they might be Kussmaul breathing rather than tachypneic, but you think, they don't look right, they're rough, they're a bit hypoxemic, whatever, that will still tell you this patient's not right, I'm still going to do the blood tests. So as I said right at the beginning, you're not saying QSOFA is a trigger to actually start treating the patient, you treat the patient in front of you. So absolutely, your spot on reading of the flow chart. The QSOFA is a prompt to make you think, is this patient sick? Do they have organ dysfunction? Let me formally try and diagnose it and look for the creatinine, look for the platelets, etc.
Fair enough. Okay, let's get to septic shock. There is a couple of places in the paper where a few additions of words have made me either love or fear this definition because it keeps changing. And the words that are there are, you need obviously a map of less than 65 requiring vasopressors after a reasonable amount of fluid. We all understand that. That's been there for, you know, a decade. But then it's and a serum lactate greater than 2 after appropriate fluid resuscitation. And those last after appropriate fluid resuscitation words are there sometimes and not others. And if you truly meant them to be there, I love this definition.
Yep, they are truly there.
And I think in the minds of every pundit I've heard comment on them, those words are not appreciated or even left in. And I think there wasn't enough emphasis on them because it's brilliant. Because there are so many patients I see with a lactate of 5 who after 1 liter of fluid has a lactate of 1. And obviously they weren't all that sick. So you're saying persistent lactate after fluid resuscitation. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So if unfortunately, because, you know, we read and reread and reread those papers hundreds of times, but you're absolutely 100% right. This is after adequate fluid resuscitation. You still have a raised lactate and a low MAP requiring vasopressors to get the MAP up. So absolutely after adequate. Now, what does adequate mean? Again, we had lots of discussions. There is no literature base, no evidence base to say what does adequate mean. Different people use different tools, you know, and so, and I know the Surviving Sepsis campaign's having these sort of arguments at the moment. What does adequate mean? You know, because different people love different things. And again, it comes down to religion, belief, what tools you have available. So we thought it's an argument we shouldn't get into because, you know, there would be a furore if we said, no, adequate fluid resuscitation means you have to do X. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about the 30 mil per kilo target or level, which, you know, I would argue some people don't need 30 and some people need a lot more than 30 mils per kilo. So you can't use then 30 mils per kilo as a marker of adequate. And so we intentionally sort of ducked out of trying to define adequate. But again, just to emphasize the point you made, and then hopefully you'll carry on loving septic shock and the definitions. But absolutely what you're saying is right. After adequate fluid resuscitation, if the lactate is still raised and the blood pressure is still low, requiring vasopressors to get it above 65.
I think you folks got this one exactly right. This is a better definition. There are definitely patients who, just because they don't have such a great catechol system, probably due to age, are hypotensive. You put them on a little vasopressor and they do great and they don't die. And
absolutely,
those patients, they're now knocked out of the definition. And
correct.
Indeed. I've taken up far too much of your time. Is there any closing thoughts or message you want to get across to people on sepsis 3.0?
Much indeed, Scott, for the opportunity to wax lyrical. I'm sure in a way, the nice thing about the definitions is that it has encouraged people to think, to argue. I think hopefully once we can allay the fears, hopefully people who've listened to the podcast will think, well, actually, they're not as bad as we thought, or, well, actually, yeah, maybe there is some sense to it, that things will settle down. And again, we'll look forward and prospectively collect. And I think collecting more data is key to actually understanding what we're doing, you know, and the risk stratification, you know, will hopefully help in identifying people we need to worry about more. You know, lactate's being used at present. The NICE guidelines say, well, perhaps lactate isn't so good as it's made out to be. Maybe QSOFA is as good. Let's find out.
All right, folks, so that's what I got for you this week. That's the first foray into discussing sepsis 3.0. I'm sure we're going to be discussing it more both on the blog and the podcast. What am I left with? I think they're pretty good. Honestly, if you look back at the sepsis 2.0 definitions, there was very little evidence basis. There is very little to hang your hat on. I still feel we need a screen at triage in the emergency department, and that may be the case on the floor as well, aside from what's mentioned in sepsis 3.0. They didn't delve into that. That's not what their definitions are about. So I'm going to continue using a screen. I think there is work to be done on validating screens for triage that could be done without lab tests by nursing. That needs to be done. I'm going to continue using what I'm using for that. But the actual definitions of once I've screened a patient and now I'm examining them and they have infection, do they have sepsis or not? I'm thinking QSOFA is not so bad. I might use it in combination with lactate. We'll see how that plays out. SOFA in the ICU? Well, I'm going to leave that to my brethren who work up there full-time because I don't do that anymore. I'm full-time ED critical care, so we'll let some intensivists come on the show and comment on their use of SOFA, good, bad, indifferent. I like the definitions of septic shock now. Why? Because it puts everyone on a really clean playing field. It's no longer just these patients who are pure hypotension, no signs of organ failure, no signs of systemic stress at all that are going to be called septic shock and then have mortality for a hospital determined on them versus a patient who is absolutely at the end game and near dead. We're all going to be speaking the same language now. We could have a relatively clean comparison of mortality. We have now patients who are requiring vasopressors after adequate fluid and whose lactates are still elevated, not even initially, but after initial fluid. My gosh, we can now all say the same thing when we say septic shock. That's why I like it. That's why I think that's really important. And it's not to say a patient with a lactate of 6 who does not get hypotensive yet, or a patient whose lactate starts off at 6 and maybe clears down to 4, I'm going to just blow that patient off. No, I'm going to still give critical care to that patient, but they don't get to be called septic shock by these new definitions. What they get to be called is septic. And sepsis becomes a quite sick degree of prognostication with these new definitions. And that's good because now, again, we're all speaking the same language. So you're infected. And that doesn't mean you get sent home. There's going to be patients who aren't septic, who are infected, who are sick enough to stay. There's sepsis, either QSOFA or SOFA score. And then there's septic shock. And the latter one, the septic shock one, all of a sudden, we're speaking the same language. We're speaking about the same degree of sickness in a cohort. And we could start comparing whether things in studies and in clinical medicine do well by these patients or not. So that's my take on it. What do you think? Put all of your comments in the show notes. That's the best place for them so we can keep them all together. I know you're going to comment on Twitter, Reddit, et cetera, but it would be great if you could come on over to the MCRIT site and actually put them in the show notes because then we could all see them and we could all discuss them. Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast saying bye-bye.